Welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies, the podcast where we revisit movies from our 20-plus years of collecting films on obsolete formats, or as I keep saying, basically we review films from the VHS era, though we don't always talk about films on VHS. And in honor of our 22nd episode, we decided that this would be our first double feature podcast. So our films for this episode are, from 1994, Even Cowgirls Get the Blues by, of course, Gus Van Sant, and the 1987 Adventures in Babysitting. And we have them both on VHS, getting them both from the same place on the same day we watched them, which was our friend Dusty, friend of the podcast, shopkeep of Pleasant Dreams Records, and purveyor of Pittsburgh VHS, had a little special secret sale that we partook in of the leftover films, basically. The good stuff makes to the shop. What's the other stuff going to do? We bought 63 movies that
something
day?
Something like that, yeah.
Something like that. And these are two of them. These are certainly two films that we now own.
Which might take our collection up to around 1,000 VHS tapes.
Yes.
That doesn't include our DVD and CD.
Or Laserdisc.
Laserdisc, yeah.
So and CD. We also have DVD and Blu-ray. We're not total, you know, whatever. But in terms of VHS, we probably have over 1,000 VHS now.
Yep.
With this big haul, yes. So yeah, these are two films we watched in the same night. And one was really good, or at least fun, or at least watchable, and one wasn't.
And one was empowering to women, and one wasn't.
And of course, you know, when you're comparing a Gus Van Sant film to Adventures in Babysitting, you figure it's going to be the Gus Van Sant film, but actually, it's Adventures in Babysitting was the fun-to-watch, empowering, functional movie? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't even know if Even Cowgirls Get the Blues. You could even describe that. Could you even describe that as a functional film?
No.
I don't think it functions.
Adventures of Babysitting was Christopher Columbus's first film. And yeah, as you know, he went on to do like Home Alone. He became this huge, huge director. So Adventures in Babysitting was his first film. And at least you can say it has a narrative. It has a through line. It's well paced.
Yes.
And I do feel like at the end, like, she's grown as a person and changed and feels, like, more empowered as
yes.
an individual for our lead actress, our lead in this film, which is Elizabeth Shue playing Christina, or Chris, as they call her throughout the film.
Yeah.
So what, maybe the good place to start is, though, is Even Cowgirls Get the Blues, and let's, maybe we can end on a high note.
Yes, let's do that. Let's explain Even Cowgirls Get the Blues from 1994.
Yeah.
Which is probably, you know, we both, actually, I think we pulled the box out of Dusty's garage thinking, we should have seen this movie by now.
Exactly. This is exactly why we picked it up because, you know, we're Gen Xers and I always feel this need to be a Gen Xer completist. And films and music from the 90s are still, I still gravitate towards. And I've actually, I think, started the movie a few years back, but I've never watched this movie in its entirety, though I knew kind of generally the plot. But this comes after, so, you know, at the time, Gus Van Sant would have done Drugstore Cowboy in 89, My Own Private Idaho in 91. Then he has this movie, and then he goes into 95, which is To Die For, and then Good Will Hunting, which is probably his...
Yeah.
In popular culture, his best-known one, I think for independent film, My Own Private Idaho and Drugstore Cowboy is probably, like, best-known independent, and then, of course...
Yes.
So, you know, we went into it thinking it's Gus, like, right? Like...
Yeah.
We've watched his other films. You know, I mean, Psycho was a horrible...
The Psycho Mimic...
I mean, but, like... Who remakes Alfred Hitchcock, you know?
Yeah, I mean, but you think, like, Last Days, Elephant...
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think you can say enough about, I think, for Gen Xers, the importance of My Own Private Idaho and Drugstore Cowboy as films that really capture the malaise of that era.
Yeah.
And that era of feeling like you got there late to the party, and but the world still exists. And you kind of have to do something with your life, and maybe, you know, again, the old ways don't work anymore. Which I think for me is where, in terms of the autopsy of this film, is maybe part of where it goes wrong is that in 94, it was a little late for youth-oriented culture that was still boomer culture.
Yeah.
You know, we had lived through the you can be a hippie in the early 90s period, you know, but the world had changed by then, but you still have this very Gen X-y novel from 1970, was it 74? Mid-70s, the Tom Robbins novel, even Cowgirls Get the Blues.
I think you meant boomer novel.
Boomer novel, yeah. Sorry. What did I say?
You said Gen X.
Oh, no, God, no. No, very boomery, mid-20th century American fiction novel.
Yeah.
That at least has female protagonists, but...
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this film is... I think you hit it on the nail after we read it. Like, it is a boomer film that was then made for Gen X, and that's not kind of Gen X... kind of morals and ideals in any way, shape, or form. And the acting is really flat. The storyline is kind of weird, not interesting.
It's not interesting. There's not a through line. You just go, how does this plot end? What's the tension?
Yeah.
It is possibly a romance between two women, but you're never thinking that they love each other. You never, like, see passion between them.
Right, there's no sexual chemistry
between them. Well, but of course you can ask the question in 94, were we ready for, in a major Hollywood film, female sexual chemistry. And you're never rooting for anything. I mean, that's the thing actually that blows my mind. Actually, I just looked at the two boxes. Adventures in Babysitting is 10 minutes longer. But... Even Cowgirls Get the Blues feels like a 2.5 hour movie.
It does.
It's only 96 minutes, but it feels like a 2.5 hour film because of this lack of a through line. I mean, there's the tension over the egrets and they're feeding them peyote.
Whooping cranes
and peyote. See, this is how well I remember this film already.
There's no tension, no excitement,
no romance.
Yeah.
You got Uma Thurman with big thumbs.
Right. I mean, so like the premise of the film is Uma Thurman's character Sissy is born with extra long thumbs. And so there's this like sequence in the beginning of her parents taking her to the doctors. But where the story really picks up is that she's hitchhiking across the United States and she seems to have this special power because of her giant thumbs that she can, you know, get people to pull over for her. And I think at one point she even gets like a shooting star to go a different direction. So she has like this mystical power. But she ends up getting a note from her friend, the Countess, the Countess is a hint of a trans character, which I thought was kind of interesting. But she has, the Countess gets her to come to New York and wants her to model for him again, and which ends up having her go to his ranch where she meets all these women. So that's just kind of the general premise. But there's these like weird like side stories that happen along the way. So before she goes to the ranch, she has like this brief encounter with Keanu Reeves, who unfortunately... Well, we'll talk about this. Is actually supposed to be 100% Native American, and so he has a really bad spray tan on to make him Native American. And then she just kind of has like this weird experience with this artsy group, and then she's there at the ranch, and that's where a lot of the story takes place. But she doesn't grow or change or seem to learn.
And I think it's, you know. I'm not familiar with the novel, but I think if you think about what makes a good adaptation, cinematic adaptation of a novel, is sometimes you have to streamline the story.
Yeah.
I think about Rita Hayworth in The Shawshank Redemption. There are, I think in that story, 4 or 5 wardens.
Right.
You know? Same thing with Fight Club,
where
he's got like 4 or 5 different jobs and he goes through all these things. And the script writer, you know, the screenplay adaptation just streamlines all of that out, and you kind of have a beginning, middle, and end, but you still have something, while not, you know, absolutely true to the plot, it captures the mood and the feeling of the book very well and much more efficiently. And in a really weird way, I mean, that is what this, one of the many things this adaptation lacks. It keeps all the plot points, all the characters.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. The warden in The Shawshank Redemption is the first warden in the novella, but, and has other kind of elements of the other characters in the novella, but they just put him in one person and just works.
Right.
Instead of having to restart the plot, which that's part of this journey. And it, and in a way, it makes me also feel like what I hated about the adaptation of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Like, at some point, like, oh, they're messing up another. It's a new hotel room they're messing up now. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
They're doing it again. And the thing about, yeah, you just refer to the Countess as a trans character, but isn't really a character, is a plot device. It's a trans
it's a plot device.
And so many of...
Keanu Reeves is a plot device.
All of these little characters that come in, even...
Pat Morita
and the Rain Phoenix character, who is supposedly the love interest.
Bonanza Jellybean.
They never become full people. They just crank up the wacky. I mean, it literally is one long... For me, it's one long boomer story that ends with, you had to be there, I guess. You just had to be there. You didn't know what it was like in 68, man. You just, it's a poorly told story that ends with, hey, I guess you had to be there. And then this other crazy thing happened, and it was so wild, but you don't feel it in any way.
Yeah.
As a viewer, it's profoundly annoying.
And I think this is kind of like what has happened with Wes Anderson. I think there's just like so many people who want to work with Wes Anderson. He feels the need to put them, everyone in his movie. Let me just like read you a list of some of the people that were in Cowboys. Even Cowgirls Get the Blues.
Oh, I can read it off the box if you
so
want.
I got it right here. So, of course, Uma Thurman is the star. You have Lorraine Bracco, who at the time was a pretty big actress. Angie Dickinson, Pat Morita, Keanu Reeves, John Hurt, Roseanne Arnold, Ed Begley Jr., Crispin Glover, Buck Henry, Carol Kane, Sean Young, Ken Kesey, Heather Graham, Udo Kerr. If you know, like, he's like a very independent film person. He worked with Warhol. Lynn Shay, who went on to do Insidious and a bunch of horror movies. If you like horror movies, you know her. William Barrows, Edward James Olmos, and River Phoenix. So it's like, also he has like, it seems like a ton of people who wanted to work with him, and he felt the need to kind of fit all these.
Let's put them all in there. I mean, let's face it, we also should confess, I guess we didn't like Grand Budapest Hotel.
No.
For this reason.
Yeah.
As well.
And so it's like, also, it's just like novelty to have novelty, and that kind of drives me personally crazy.
Yes.
I hate movies that just rely on shtick or some kind of...
That is the right word for this movie. It is shtick.
Yeah.
Where it could have been, and I guess the other thing is, and actually I go back to the Roger Ebert review of it, because I always like to go back to Roger Ebert, where he says he had the misfortune of seeing this film twice. He saw it at the Toronto Film Festival, and it got absolutely no reaction from the audience, and everybody just, like, he said, walked out staring at the floor. It was supposed to be out like 3 weeks after that. And they knew they were in trouble, and they completely recut the film and didn't make it any better. And the point he makes, and I think Siskel makes this point too, if you can watch the review on YouTube, he says, you know, it maybe back then in the mid-70s, you know, and this is maybe a novel that rides on the coattails of Rita Mae Brown's Ruby Fruit Jungle, which is a probably much better novel. That the thought of, hey, look, there's lesbians in this movie, look, as like, that would have been enough. There would have been enough. Oh, look, it's a novel about lesbians. Shocking. Sell those copies. Just having them exist in 1994 is not enough, and that you have to make those characters want to do something interesting.
Yeah.
And so there is the whole, like, weird... reactionary thing about the whooping cranes and, oh, the government's telling us what to do with our land, you know, which is also like, yeah, boomer, buy another SUV, or, you know, you need another V8 because you've already owned 5 cars and they were all V8s.
Yeah.
Just pump more carbon in the atmosphere and let the world die with you, yeah, kind of thing. And that's somehow heroic.
Well, you know, it's so funny too, because you look at, that kind of point about so the whooping cranes keep landing on this private ranch and they want them to stay there. So they initially feed them brown rice and then they feed them peyote, which from like a whole like environmental stance, horrible, right?
Yeah, horrible. And
this
horrible.
Endangered species. Let's give them brown rice and peyote. Awesome plan. Like that's
yeah, I, and I think
plan.
That's the thing is yeah. Also you have a sense of freedom, and it's even to watch this film now, another, you know, 20 or 30 years into the future, we're almost. Yeah, I mean, rebellion of that era was very much about conquering the world. Was very much about the triumph of the narcissistic self mm-hmm. over everything.
Yeah.
And you were inherently interesting if you did that.
Yeah.
And that's all you had to do and that's all you had to be. And there's so many movies of that era. One of these days we're going to have to do Easy Rider on CED because we have Easy Rider on CED and let's test this thesis out. And that's heroic. Whereas I think... especially now, even for young people right now, and like people my students' age, the almost the rebellious thing is like, how do you care about other people, and how do you make opportunity for other people possible, and how do you have a sense of community? Which while you're at this Rubber Rose Ranch,
yeah,
no one really feels like they're together. They're just freaking out collectively or whatever. And it's the, just that great look inward, and it's an annoying, awful film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, so, you know, Gus Van Sant is gay, right? And he mm-hmm. is a part of queer cinema and has accolades around his betrayal.
Which, again, you think about My Own Private Idaho, right. The richness and complexity of those characters.
Yeah.
And their struggle,
yeah.
And it occurs in the West. It's the same landscape, even. Yeah. The landscape in the cinematography is such a key element to both films, yeah. But one has people in it and one doesn't.
Right, and this, like, the lesbian characters in this film are just so flat, yeah. Not interesting. They all dress the same. They all talk very flat.
Yes.
No emotion. How are you today? We have to kill the cows.
Again, and the thing I do like, wonder is, it's 94. You know, the queerness of My Own Private Idaho is subtle.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it almost is that celluloid closet.
Yeah.
Like, if you're dense, you could miss it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think we rented My Own Private Idaho in college. And I think there were people over. And I think people could have just, this is a really boring movie.
Yeah.
About people. I don't get it. I mean, they're just in the West. And you don't you know what I mean? And if you get it, then you get it. And it's like, oh, wow, that's part of the world or that's part of me.
Yeah.
And my life and my experiences. And it's maybe, yeah, a little bit celluloid closet. Whereas, you know, again, 94, could you have a studio Hollywood movie that was, you know, you expect... to open in all these multiplexes in the Midwest and all these Midwestern malls, how human can your lesbians be?
I mean, that's true.
I wonder about that deeply.
But I
thinking
think
about the film now.
A part of it is, you know, the other thing is to think about, like, so Bonanza Jellybean. So, you know, Sissy gets to the ranch. The Countess owns this ranch. And so he's wealthy because he sold products. Feminine hygiene products that were specifically marketed to lesbians is how he made his money.
Yeah.
And so Sissy had been his model for years. She's returning to the ranch to do another shoot around these products. She gets there, and the cowgirls, the women who help run the ranch, decide to rebel and take the ranch over. When we get to our bottom questions, I'll talk about how offensive it is, the way they take over the ranch.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Bonanza Jelly Bean is the ringleader. No charisma whatsoever. So you have, like, no sense of, like, how she got all these women to agree with her to take over the ranch. Sissy comes and immediately falls in love with her. And there's no reason why to immediately fall in love with her. Her character is not very interesting. She knows how to, like, hypnotize chickens is her thing.
Yeah.
So there's this, like, really long, unnecessary scene of her hypnotizing chickens and Uma Thurman staring lovingly at her. But there's nothing that would say to you that... And then, you know... So the Countess sells the products, he owns the ranch, and his other goal in life is to get Sissy laid so that she's no longer a virgin.
Yeah.
So he had literally had her set up with a date with Keanu Reeves so she could lose her virginity. There's a scene where she's masturbating to the image, to the thought of Keanu Reeves, and then suddenly she's, like, 5 minutes later, a lesbian and comfortable with it.
Yeah.
So there's no tension around, like, why do I have these, suddenly have these feelings for a woman? Like, there's nothing, because up until that point, you assume that she is most likely heterosexual if she agreed to the date with Keanu Reeves to lose her virginity.
Yeah.
And then, so suddenly now, like, a few minutes later, she is now ready to jump into bed with Bonanza Jelly Bean. But again, there's no, like, tension around it, no confusion, no even just, like, oh... this is it, awakening. I'm a lesbian. Like, there's not even that moment of epiphany of, like,
I mean, think about it. She has more chemistry with the Keanu Reeves character.
She does.
Than with Bonanza Jellybean, which is, again, how heteronormative.
Yeah.
Can we stop talking about this movie now?
The thought I had, I'll probably say it again, is that, like, if you want quirky characters, and portrayal of gay people, go to John Waters. Like, he handles it so much better.
Yeah, you're right. That's another thing. It's like, I can make my John Waters movie, but without...
Yeah.
Without... And there were chickens. There were even chickens, like, in Pink Flamingos.
And John Waters would even say, like, he, you know, as a gay man, like, his initial portrayal of lesbians wasn't that flattering, and he evolved in his thinking, you know, and admitted that he had made some stumbling blocks with that. But if you want that, if you want quirky characters and a ton of, like, things about homosexuality, go to John Waters. Like, he does it so much better. And his stories at least have an arc.
Yeah.
This has no arc.
Or you could watch the Peter Jackson film...
Meet the Feebles?
No, not Meet the Feebles. The love story.
Oh my gosh, I forgot the name of it.
Oh, we had the total brain fart. The Peter Jackson movie was Beautiful Darlings? Beautiful Creatures?
Heavenly Creatures.
Heavenly Creatures. Heavenly Creatures.
That's the better movie.
It's a real podcast. We don't do razor blade edits, folks. Heavenly Creatures, which is of the same era.
Yeah.
Which there is a profound complexity and humanity to those characters, even if they, like, kill the mom.
Yeah.
Which you know about. It's not a spoiler. It's in the first scene.
Yeah.
Anyway, Adventures in Babysitting.
So we did watch both of them in the same night. So
and I think Adventures in Babysitting was like the palate cleanser because I needed a movie with a plot.
Yeah.
You know, I think as I get older, the one unforgivable sin in a movie for me is now bad pacing. Like, and the lack of a through line, that is unforgivable. Even if it's a through line that I don't, like, you watch, like, Parasite. You know, and the way that film evolves from a quirky comedy to what it becomes. That ride, I feel like I've been taking on that ride so well. And even when you look back and go, oh, this whole movie is, and, you know, it's one of those films that plays the joke or the trick on you is like when it stops being serious. When's that moment where you're like, oh, these people are monsters, you know, kind of thing that happens in that film. But you still feel like, wow, you know, I've just been the rising action. That movie doesn't end like you think it's gonna. But still, you're taken on a ride, and you feel like you're going at a good pace. It's unforgivable. It's absolutely unforgivable. So Adventures in Babysitting.
Yeah.
1987, Christopher Columbus.
Yep.
Hometown Spangler, Pennsylvania, which is a town that no longer exists, now known as Northern Cambria, after merging with Barnesboro in 2000. Anyway. Yeah, it's about a babysitter who
introduced by Deborah Hill, which she did all of like John Carpenter's films, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, you know, the thing I think that is delightful about Adventures in Babysitting is it is the Saturday night movie that your babysitter might have maybe gotten in trouble for letting you watch. It is PG-13, I guess, yeah. And there's some jokes, there's some things that kids say and they shouldn't say.
Yeah.
But it is like the Saturday night pizza. You just watched Big Trouble in Little China last week. You gotta watch something else this week for your Saturday night movie. Why not Adventures in Babysitting?
That is so funny. That is so true. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, it is Christopher Columbus's first film. And as we said, he went on to do Home Alone, but he also went on and did Harry Potter films. And so you can tell he's going to be a talented director if you like those type of films, right?
Yeah.
Like, he gets action, he gets pacing, he gets rising tension. He does get good performances out of his actors. So you do see kind of this glimpse of the person he's going to become and the success that he'll have in the future. So the premise of Adventures in Babysitting is we have a high school senior, Chris, who was supposed to go out on a date with her boyfriend. He said he can't. He ditches her. He ghosts her. And today, in today's kids' terms, he ghosted her.
Yeah, and you think he is right out of central casting douchebag boyfriend,
yeah.
Including the fact that he has a Camaro with personalized license plates that say "so cool."
And you know who he grows up to be? The dad from Get Out.
That is right.
Yeah, he's the dad from Get Out. It's like that's his arc.
Douchebag boyfriend to dad from Get Out. That's amazing.
That's amazing. But anyway, so she ends up babysitting for a girl, her brother, and the brother's friend. And she has her best friend, who is... Oh, Brad and Sarah are the kids. Her best friend, played by Penelope Ann Miller, who was in Kindergarten Cop, which we just watched not too long ago. She plays Brenda. Brenda decides to run away from home. She's at the train station in downtown Chicago and freaks out and calls Chris and asks Chris to come pick her up, which is where the adventures start happening.
Yes, one of the interesting things for me about this film and the way that it is maybe dated for its time, though maybe not for everybody, it's just like suburbia. It's this suburbia story, but the adventure is that you go into sort of urban warfare and this way that urban space is seen as inherently wild, inherently dangerous, which, yeah, was, I think, being a kid growing up outside of New York City in the 1980s, that was New York is where you go to get killed. Not where the culture is, not where commerce is, not where humanity is.
Yeah.
It's very much portrayed as this infinitely dangerous, we're going to get in trouble if they find out we're in the city because it's the city. You know, and it is that tension, I think, of being a kid from that era, right? Your parents fled the city so you could, quote, have the good life.
Yeah.
And you're terminally bored, and, you know, it also has that Breakfast Club quality because there's like the tension, the romance between, or the love triangle between Chris, the douchebag boyfriend, and the boy she's babysitting.
Yeah. Well, it's also interesting. So the other thing, and I grew up right outside of Philadelphia, so like that was so part of my life growing up is like, don't go into Philadelphia by yourself. You know, that kind of thing, you know, but so they're living obviously in upper middle class neighborhood outside of Chicago. And they have this adventure going into the city. The thing I love about it is the parents aren't a huge presence in that film.
Yeah, it is kid world.
It was very much a kid world. And, you know, like there was a period of time where you don't really get that, where it's like parents are a much more present in films.
Yeah, this is very much a latchkey kid movie.
It's very much a lot like The Gate, like the, you know, like The Gate where the parents.
Yeah,
are
the
like,
parents are just not
there. The parents are like kind of really not a big part of the film in any way, shape, or form. Like Ferris Bueller's Day Off too, you know, like it's just kind of you don't have the parents be a part of it, and it's very much this kid world, and it's very much how would. Kids, and you know, we all remember being seniors in high school feeling like we're grown, but like really 18-year-olds, you're not.
Yeah.
Like, you know, how would an 18-year-old, a 15-year-old, I think the boy is like, I think he says he's in high school, so I believe he's a freshman. So Brad, who has a crush on Chris, he's like 15. So you have an 18-year-old, two 15-year-olds, and like a 7-year-old. How do they navigate this space,
this city space, at night,
the city at night, and all these, you know, potential dangers that can occur to them. And so, I mean, like, the plot is kind of, you have to definitely suspend belief in some.
Yes.
In some ways.
Yes.
So kind of the first, so they have to go pick up Brenda, you know, so Elizabeth, Shue, so as Chris, she grabs Brad and Sarah and Brad's friend Daryl. They all jump in the station wagon, Buick station wagon, head down or make their way to downtown Chicago. Tire blows out. She forgot her wallet. And so you have a truck driver who, a tow truck driver, sees them in peril, stops to get them, and says he'll help them. So part of the thing that I do like about this, right, is that though they're interacting with people in the city, there's a humanity of the people from
in
the city,
yeah.
Right?
Even the car thief has a heart of gold.
They even right, but I think that's true. But I do think it's nice to think of like the vast majority of people they meet in the city are actually reasonable people, right? Like they actually do kind of care about others. So the tow truck driver offers to help them for free because you know he says, "What kind of person would I be if I left a bunch of kids alone in the city?" Right?
Yeah,
you
on know, the side of the road.
On the side of the road. But what ends up happening is that the owner of the shop radios in, says, "I saw this guy's car parked in front of your house." So they end up in front of his house and a shootout ensues.
Jealous husband deal.
Yeah, you know, fight. And they end up hopping into a car for safety, which is being in the middle of being hotwired by a car thief. And then the car thief takes them to the hideout where they're chopping the cars. Like, really? Like, so there's these moments where you're like, really, the car thief would not have taken them to the hideout, which ends up, because they see where everything is, they end up with a magazine that has important information. They suddenly have these gangsters, three gangsters, out to get them.
And the three gangsters are straight out of Central Casting. We need three gruff-looking Italian men or something, or urban men.
Yeah.
Who are running a car chop shop operation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So that ends up with them kind of going through the city and getting into these different hijinks along the way. Off her, she discovers her boyfriend out on a date with another girl.
At the fancy restaurant they were supposed to go to tonight.
They end up at a frat party where they get money. She ends up singing at a jazz...
At a
blues club.
Because, you know...
You have to sing the blues.
You have to sing the blues.
So they have all these different adventures.
Chicago blues.
They actually have the little girl, Sarah, is obsessed with Thor, which actually predates this whole interest in Marvel films and Thor. Which gets them their car back because she thinks that the owner of the shop is Thor and he's charmed by it. They get Brenda, they get home. No one's the wiser around what happens. So, you know, there is these moments of tension, these moments of suspending disbelief. She meets a new guy at the frat party.
Yes.
But you do feel like as the film progresses, she grows as a person. She realizes her strengths, but she also realizes some of her weaknesses, that she's kind of snobby, that she... like would never say hi to Brad in the hallway and realize, you know, develops like these relationships and closeness. And she realizes she's tougher than she thought she was, right?
Yeah.
So there's the ridiculous scene on the subway where she confronts the gang members.
Yeah, I think that, again, urban space is dangerous space. So the warriors have, the warriors breaks out in the middle of the film where you have two rival gangs, one subway car, and
Yeah. So, though, I will say it was fun. It is very entertaining.
I mean, it's John Hughes light. It's John Hughes without the social consciousness.
Yes.
You know, you don't, like with the Breakfast Club.
Yeah.
You know, you don't, oh, wow, all these people, they're all people, and we all have our own invisible things that we're struggling with. You know, I mean, it doesn't quite go meta the way John Hughes can go meta.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah. So I do find it, like, empowering in a way, because she is... She kind of finds herself, she finds her strength, she navigates this really tense, difficult situation, gets everyone back
in one piece, safe in one piece, and gets the guy.
And gets the guy, gets the house
cleaned
up. Doesn't
get in trouble, gets the car fixed.
Yeah, gets everything together. But it's just a fun, it's a popcorn film, but it's just a fun, fun film.
And it has a discernible plot
and
pacing.
And you root for Chris. Like, you end up liking her.
And that's the thing. There is not a character in, not to go back, but we are. Maybe we should think about going back. She's the most well-evolved character. If she was put in Cowgirls Get the Blues, she would be the fullest, most complete character. She is more full and complete than Uma Thurman's character in even the Cowgirls.
Yes.
Get the Blues.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think she, you know, like, Elizabeth Shue's a good actress. I mean, she went on to do Leaving Las Vegas and a bunch of other things. She's a talented actress, and I think a young Elizabeth Shue showed her ability as an actress in this film.
Mm-hmm.
Overall, if you want to suspend your belief a little bit around it,
well, I think fun. You can only... This film, also, you can only, I think, you have to put the glass bubble around and say, oh, 1987.
Yeah.
I think the way that we're thinking about urban space, the people that live in urban space, those kinds of jokes that arise from that, you know, the lack of cell phones, credit cards, PayPal, anything that could have gotten them out of trouble a hell of a lot more efficiently.
Yeah. What was the 80s, right? You had to find a payphone somewhere.
Yeah, had to find a payphone somewhere. You either, if you didn't have your checkbook, you only had the cash that was on you.
Yeah.
And that's it.
That's it.
And so, all of those things, and the way people, I think, deal with each other socially, can only have that. You have to, I think, see it. Part of that suspension of disbelief is, it's the 80s. It's an 80s caper film, which we don't do as well or as much fun as it used to be.
Do you want to go to the questions?
Yes, let us go to the big four. I guess for both films, camp, retro, classic, or just old movies?
I think... I don't know. What's your thought?
My thought, I think Adventures in Babysitting is camp. Again, that bubble. I mean, it's a popcorn movie that's fun and dumb.
Yeah.
And is complete in 103 minutes, and you're out.
Yeah.
Even Cowgirls Get the Blues. It's just an old movie, but... And I think this is, you know, part of question four. Is it a keeper as well? It is Gus Van Sant. He is one of those directors that I think his bad outings are still forgivable. You know, he's the baseball pitcher who wins 20 games, but, you know, one start in the middle of July, he gets knocked out in the third inning because he gave up 6 runs.
Mm.
You still want him, 5 days from now, you still want to give him the ball again, and you think good things are going to happen. But this is definitely, even Cowgirls Get the Blues, is definitely, he's knocked out of there in the third inning, and they're not winning the game.
So for me, So, you know, like, a cult film is often initially not well received, and then you go years afterwards revisiting it and finding something in it. I couldn't find anything in
no,
it for
it's
me.
No, not in there.
So for me, it's just an old film. I was hoping it was going to be a cult classic as we watched it, but it was just an old film. You know, Adventures in Babysitting is campy, but fun. It's very, very fun in its campiness.
All right, question two. What about the social political distance, seeing these films in 2021? I think I said it about a little bit with Adventures in Babysitting, that way that urban space is portrayed. And again, this is, it's funny because when I was a kid, I was 10 years old when this movie came out. My generational cohort, at least all of my friends that I grew up with outside of New York City, whose friends fled New York City for New Jersey, all but about two of them have, most of them have moved back into the city. And see urban space as the space where you live, and we live. We have a city address as we're recording this podcast and storing these VHS tapes in our basement.
Yeah, I mean, I think at least for Adventures in Babysitting, you can say it, at least it acknowledges that people of color exist in a city. Sometimes, like, when you have a film like that, you don't encounter it. I will say it does feel like a checklist. Like, one white homeless person, check. One black homeless person, check. One bad black guy, check.
And those scenes at the bus station are just so cartoonish.
It does feel like there's a checklist. Like, there's the black character with a heart of gold, check. Oh, but a black character who's bad, check. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I do feel like there feels like this checklist. But they do acknowledge that there are people of color who exist in the city. They do acknowledge that there's homeless people in the city and things. Though it's comical, right? Like, it does at least have kind of the gradation. You do see the poor
and
the poor. And
you have, I think, again, this female character that gets empowered, that learns something about herself and manages a crisis.
Can we imagine, like, for, like, so I get this book was written in the 70s, but even the Cowgirls Get the Blue, the Asian American character is called Chink. Which...
Hard pass.
Oh my gosh.
Again, is, that generation's notion of what rebellion is and establishing one's identity is kind of about being a dick to other people.
Yeah.
And demeaning other people is really important for rebellion of that era. Hard pass.
Even the dynamic between the Countess and the lesbians who take over his camp is like the Countess. He basically says like he is like a Russian Countess stuck in a white man's body. Like so, says trans, right? Like a trans character, which. Cool, that's exciting. But then he has this contentious relationship with the gay women on his farm, right? And so, like, does that also, does that dynamic have to exist? Does it have to be, like, can a gay man have to fight
gay
women?
That sort of war for turf, war for recognition, and to hell with everybody else.
The part that kind of really also rubs me, so the Chink really character really rubbed me the wrong way. But the way they get the ranch is that they don't bathe and they don't provide any hygiene to their vagina and to their feminine part area.
And the smell overwhelms the Countess.
How degrading
dumb.
To women is that kind of it was that
yeah
like,
and
it, that
yeah,
was just,
yeah
like weird
yeah
that was just gross and kind of weird. So though it has you know it's a film predominantly women, like it's the majority of the cast is women, which is exciting to see, and there are women of color that are included in it, but it's just like just how the women are portrayed, and they're so flat, uninteresting. So when I was watching it, it made me think of this Saturday Night Live skit from a few years ago, where it's like four rebellious teens from the 50s and 60s are dancing to music in the street, and the copper comes up and he's like, "Turn down the music," and they're like, "No, we're gonna dance and do what we want to do." That's exactly what it felt like. It was like with it. So you want to celebrate this film because it does focus on lesbian characters, but man,
no,
they're not great.
Which leads in the question three, the technical distance,
room
test.
So definitely for Adventures in Babysitting, it's very much an 80s film. As you mentioned, there's no cell phone, no PayPal.
No ATMs.
No ATMs. None of that stuff exists.
Yeah, and so you have this delicious tension that, and they're alone and nobody knows we're here and nobody knows how we're going to get money to get the car fixed so we could go home and... All of that,
and
the parents are out in the city and having a dinner party or whatever, they're at a party at dad's work, you know, there would have been texting, there would have been, text messages going back and forth. Yeah, so there's that. Other than that, I think the film looks really good.
Yeah.
You know, I think Uma Thurman's fake thumbs in even Cowgirls Get the Blues are just really bad looking.
Yeah.
They're really bad makeup effects. I think they also kind of change size throughout the movie.
Yeah.
In, like, the way a B-movie would.
Yeah. I mean, of course, also for the Cowgirls Get the Blues, because it was set in the 70s, again, you don't see any, like, computers or cell phones. The funny thing about it is, like, we talked about, I think at one point, I'm like, when is this supposed to be set?
Yeah, they don't do period very well.
They don't do period very well.
You know, because also, you know, that's the thing. Even the cars are so stylistic. Some of the people who stop, you think, they're just hot rodders in the 90s. And you could see that car. It's like, oh, no, it's the 70s.
Yeah.
Like, so that, again, this, like, how wacky can we make it? Can we make the next character you meet even wackier than the one before it? And, you don't know what era it is. Question four. Are these films keepers?
So, Adventures in Babysitting, for me, is a keeper. It does...
It's fun.
It's fun. I could revisit it again. I'm not going to watch even Cowgirls Get the Blues again.
Yeah.
I just have no interest. It left such a bad taste in my mouth. I looked it up, and so this is the accolades that it got. Let me just tell you. Golden Raspberry Award for Worst Actress. She was nominated, but she lost to Sharon Stone for Uma Thurman. And then Worst Supporting Actress Awards. And they were on the multiple worst lists for people. And I think it cost around $8 million to make, and it only made like $1.7 million.
Oof.
So
it's a cheap movie that still lost money.
It's a cheap movie that still lost money, and there isn't any redeeming
qualities. Other than the director was somebody real.
Yeah.
And he just had a bad start.
Yeah.
It's, you know.
And, you know, the film is dedicated to River Phoenix. And I think, Rain Phoenix, who played Bonanza Jellybean, she never really went on to other films.
Because she couldn't act?
She couldn't act. So I think people were like, she can't act.
Oof.
I have no... Will we keep it? Yes, because of who the director is. But I have no interest in rewatching
that film ever again.
Again.
We might forget 20 years from now.
Yeah.
Be like, wait, this is Gus Van Sant? I remember him.
Yeah.
Maybe. That's the best shot that movie's got.
Yeah.
Probably could watch Adventures in Babysitting again, as in COVID times we have people over sometime to watch movies socially distantly in our backyard. Yeah, you could put that tape in and it'd be fun.
And everyone's going to have fun with it.
Yeah.
But there's not anything in even Cowgirls Get the Blues that I felt like was redeeming or interesting or even like technically interesting. Like there wasn't anything about it that...
And I couldn't imagine what the longer cut looks like.
Yeah. Ouch.
On that note, we're done. We're out. Double feature. Maybe we'll do the double feature again.
Yep.
Who knows?
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.